continuing this series on the relevance of the biblical predictions for our 20th century, we would now propose to deal with the prophecies of the first half of the book of Daniel. Let us first take a look at Daniel chapter 2, the correct interpretation of which is essential for the right understanding of the closely related Daniel chapter 7. In the second chapter, we have a prediction revealed in a dream of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. It was disclosed in the second year of his reign, or around 604 B.C. Sometime later, but probably well before 600 B.C., the divinely inspired Daniel infallibly interpreted the dream. The dream, said Daniel, related to the future history of the world. For the great image of a man seen by Nebuchadnezzar in his dream represents four successive world empires. The golden head of the image represents the golden kingdom of the Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar himself. The breasts and the two arms of silver of the image represent the subsequent imperial kingdom, the twin Medo-Persian Empire, which would succeed the Babylonian Imperium when Darius the Mede took over Babylon from Nebuchadnezzar's son Belshazzar in 538 B.C. The brass belly and thighs of the image represent the subsequent Grecian world empire of Alexander the Great, which pulverized the Persians in 330 B.C. And the iron legs and feet of the image represent the subsequent world empire which destroyed the Grecian kingdom. That subsequent empire could therefore only be Rome. Thus, ancient Jewish writers, the secular historian of Rome, Edward Gibbon, the early church fathers, the Protestant reformers, and many others. But the Roman feet and the 10 toes of the image with the iron legs were themselves brittle, being made of iron and clay. Now, all four of these kingdoms manifest a basic continuity with one another as parts of one image, in spite of their several differences. But then a new and entirely different kind of kingdom would be established, one which would ultimately reduce the image to powder. This fifth kingdom would appear and destroy the pagan political machine long before the end of world history. For this everlasting fifth kingdom would be established already in the days of the fourth kingdom of pagan Rome, which only lasted from perhaps 338 B.C. through 321 A.D. Indeed, the fifth kingdom of Christ Jesus, the messianic stone, would be established just midway between 338 B.C. and 351 A.D., or in 0 through 35 A.D. For that messianic kingdom hit the Roman legs and the feet of Nebuchadnezzar's image long before it started to break up into the 10 toes between A.D. 351 and 476 with the post-Constantinian attacks of the barbarians on Rome. Now, this new messianic fifth empire is compared to a stone cut without hands out of the mountain of Old Testament Israel. The stone apparently rolls down the mountain out into all the world, smashing the image and ultimately consuming it. Yet the messianic stone kingdom itself keeps on rolling even after that, until it itself becomes a great mountain, or the worldwide Christian church, which fills the whole earth and then stands there forever. From the New Testament, It is clear that this stone is the kingdom of Jesus Christ. We are told, even by Jewish authorities like Josephus and the ancient rabbis, that the stone is messianic. And all Christian authorities of whatever eschatological persuasion throughout church history, from Eusebius through Rushduni, agree with this identification. The messianic stone of Christ's expanding kingdom ultimately overcomes all the kingdoms of the world, Christianizes them, and amalgamates them into itself by way of conquest. This Christian conquest of the kingdoms of this world, however, is fulfilled in progressive stages. First, it is fulfilled in Christ's own virgin birth. Second, it is proclaimed in Christ's own resurrection from the dead and ascension into heaven. And third, it is increased in the church's progressive and expansive triumph. For the church triumphs first over Judaism and then over heathen Rome. It triumphs over pagan Rome, especially after the conversion of Emperor Constantine. It triumphs over the so-called Holy Roman Empire and even over the papal Rome, which succeeded heathen Rome at the time of the Protestant Reformation of the Church, and its triumph then. And at a still later time, the Church will also triumph over the subsequent religious whore and international political beast of the humanism of the French and Russian revolutions, after they themselves further wound the Romish papacy, the papacy which produced them. This revolutionary humanism may yet be recombined with the Romish Vatican before the final destruction of both. Possibly such recombination may yet occur as a result of the Euromark Treaty of Rome after World War II, as perhaps also evidenced by the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Perhaps it may further be recombined by the Romish Vatican's modern and ever-increasing flirtation with communism. And it may even be recombined still further by the Rome-based papal role in integrating the ever-increasing socio-economic synthesis of many of the non-Christian religions and political powers of our modern day, which we will give copious details of later. But all of these anti-Christian kingdoms of this world have either already been destroyed or else shall yet be destroyed. And they have been and are being or shall be destroyed in their continuity with one another. For their continuity runs from ancient pagan Rome through medieval papal Romanism and its unruly liberal or pseudo-Protestant daughters. And those very unruly daughters also include French revolutionary humanism and revived modern Vaticanism and pseudo-ecumenical devices. Such devices are clearly evident in the modern Treaty of Rome to integrate socialistically the post-World War II common market economy of Western Europe. They are evident in the Romish Vatican's overtures toward the apostate liberal and pseudo-Protestant and Eastern so-called Orthodox and syncretistic worldly council of churches. And they are also evident in the papacy's increasing flirtations with both democratic socialism in Western Europe and the international communist conspiracy in Eastern Europe and in China. But the ever-expanding stone of Christ's kingdom breaks up and progressively destroys Nebuchadnezzar's Roman image and consumes it. And after that, the messianic stone itself rolls on and yet becomes a great mountain which fills the whole earth as the waters cover the sea. Now we are given a more detailed account of the above philosophy of history in Daniel chapter 7. This chapter was apparently recorded some 60 years after the first vision. It was just before the Medo-Persian conquest of Babylon that Daniel received this second vision in about 542 B.C. In this new vision, Daniel saw four successive beasts rise up out of the sea. These beasts were identified as four kings or kingdoms, and they are obviously the same four kingdoms as those previously described in Daniel chapter 2. For the first beast, or winged lion, represents the kingdom of Babylon, as archaeological discoveries of statues of winged lions found there serve to confirm. The second beast, or lopsided bear, represents the top-heavy kingdom of Medo-Persia, which would soon replace the Babylonian Empire in 538 B.C. The third beast, or four-headed and four-winged leopard, represents the swiftly expanding Grecian Empire of Alexander the Great. This was the empire which would overwhelm the cumbersome Medo-Persia, but which would itself soon thereafter split up into four Hellenistic sub-empires, each under its own head after Alexander the Great's death in 323 B.C. And the fourth dreadful and terrible beast with iron teeth and ten horns represents the empire which conquered Greece. This was obviously the Roman Empire, or the fourth kingdom previously represented by Daniel chapter 2's iron legs and ten toes of the image in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. As such, it is a clear conviction of the vast majority of both Jewish and Christian expositors that this is the identity. Now the prophecy of Daniel next mentions that the thrones of these four world empires were cast down and that the messianic throne of the fifth kingdom was set up. This happened when the messianic Son of Man came to the Ancient of Days with the clouds of heaven. This occurred at Christ's resurrection and ascension. Compare the resurrection stone of Daniel chapter 2. For Christ's resurrection, followed by his ascension and his heavenly session, was the time when he openly despoiled all of the principalities and powers here on earth and openly triumphed over them. It was then at the resurrected Christ's ascension that he came with the clouds back from the earth and to his Father in heaven, namely, right after his first coming from heaven to our earth. It is true that this system of pagan world kingdoms, including the heathen Roman Empire, was overthrown in principle at the time of Christ's ascension and heavenly session. But that system of world empires still needs to be overthrown in actualization, in practice too. Indeed, it is even now being overthrown by the Christians as Christ's earthly people indwelt by his Spirit under the direction of his orders as our head in heaven. Yet it is being overthrown in progressive stages, for it is clear that even after Christ's ascension and heavenly session had in principle shattered the Roman beast, the latter still lived on to persecute the Christian saints for many centuries thereafter. It's true, of course, that some of our brethren believe that Christ's coming on the cloud of heavens back to his Father in Daniel 7 is the second coming. But if you read it carefully, you'll see it applies to his ascension into heaven on the clouds, back to his heavenly Father, and this position is the clear exegesis of Daniel 7, verse 13, as given by the Geneva Bible, John Calvin, the Dutch States Bible, Matthew Poole, Matthew Henry, Jonathan Edwards, Adam Clark, David Brown, Patrick Fairburn, C. Van Proustday, B. H. Carroll, and many others. Indeed, even Schofield himself admits that Daniel 7, verse 13, refers to the investiture of the Son of Man with the kingdom prior to his vexing of the heathen and prior to his still later return. Now, the fifth empire, or kingdom of the Lord Jesus, now that it has been established on earth by Christ himself, shall never be destroyed. To the contrary, it constantly increases while progressively destroying all other kingdoms as they constantly decrease. However, the complete destruction of Christ's enemies has not yet been accomplished. The whole war lasts for many centuries, and during that time, Christ's enemies sometimes win battles, or at least skirmishes, against the people of God. Daniel identified the 10 horns of the fourth or Roman beast as 10 kings that would later arise. They would do so after the emergence of the fourth or Roman kingdom itself. Just as the 10 toes in the feet of Nebuchadnezzar's image followed after the firm iron legs of the Roman Empire. Just as the 10 kingdoms of Western Europe would arise out of the remnants of the Roman Empire and before the rise of the Romish papacy. And just as the originally undivided heathen Roman Empire itself had succeeded the Grecian Empire, and the latter, in its turn, had succeeded its Medo-Persian and Babylonian predecessors. Now, while Daniel, in his vision, was considering the 10 horns of the Roman beast, another little horn slowly grew out of the scalp on the head of the Roman beast. This new little horn grew larger and larger until it became so strong and so big or stout that it uprooted 3 of the other lesser 10 horns. And this new and stout Roman horn had eyes and a mouth like a man, and arrogantly spoke very great things. It grew in size from a little horn into a horn more stout, or much larger than the others. And then it persecuted the Christian saints, but only for a time and times and the dividing of time, until those Christian saints themselves take away the stout and arrogant horn's dominion and themselves take possession of the kingdom or the rulership of the empire of the world forever and ever, under the control of the Messiah who left the earth on the clouds of heaven to take up his human position on the throne of the universe at the right hand of the Ancient of Days. First, however, the Christian saints would be persecuted by the stout and arrogant Roman horn for a time and times and the dividing of time. In this expression, the singular word time is followed by the dual word times in the original Aramaic text of this part of the book of Daniel. Being dual, it means two. It is not plural in number, which would imply 3 or more times, according to the nature of the Aramaic language. Instead, it is dual in number, 2 times. The next phrase in the expression, the phrase, the dividing of time, means half a time. Hence the entire expression, a single time, and dual times, and the dividing or half of one time means 3.5 times, or half of the sabbatical 7 times. Now, a time must mean a year in prophecy, inasmuch as the book of Revelation itself identifies Daniel's 3.5 times as 3.5 prophetic years, or 42 prophetic months, or 1260 prophetic days. Moreover, we have seen that each day in prophecy is equivalent to one actual year in its fulfillment on the already established day-year principle of prophetic time. Hence, Daniel's 3.5 times in his 7th chapter amounts to a period of 3.5 prophetic day years, or 42 prophetic months, or 1260 prophetic days, that is, to 1260 literal day years. This means a period of 1260 real years. Thus, very many Jewish commentators, and thus too both Romish and Protestant theologians, from the 250 B.C. Alexandrine Septuagint Daniel right through the A.D. 1948 B.H. Carroll. It is during these 3.5 times, or 1260 years, that the new, arrogant, and stout Roman horn persecutes the saints. Interestingly, even many theologians, such as the A.D. 991 Arnulf of Orleans, Eberhard of Salzburg, John Wycliffe, and Walter Brute, in pre-Reformational times, took the view that this stout and arrogant horn is indeed to be identified with the Romish papacy. So too did medieval Jews, such as Don Isaac Abravanel, and many Eastern Orthodox theologians down to the present day, such as Apostolos Makrakis. Moreover, this was the unanimous opinion of all of the Protestant reformers and of all of their immediate successors, even though it's true that Calvin, in his commentary on Daniel 7, does not so say this, but he does say it in other parts of his writings, in the Institutes, and in his analysis of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. It's also still the opinion of many Protestant theologians even today. And yet all these theologians have regarded the arrogant, anti-Christian Roman stout horn not as a specific pope, but as the continuous institution of the Romish papacy as such, as it has existed down through the Christian centuries. In general, it is especially infidels like Porphyry and modernists like S.R. Driver and dispensationalists who have sought to argue that Daniel 7 verse 8's arrogant stout horn and Daniel 8 verse 9's exceeding great horn is not the papacy, but merely the B.C. 167 Antiochus Epiphanes. The evidence is overwhelming, however, that Daniel 7 verse 8's arrogant and stout horn, and I believe Daniel 8 verse 9's exceeding great horn, is not the Syrian Antiochus Epiphanes, although I believe there are other references to him in Daniel 11, but rather the enduring institution of the Romish papacy. Let us now hear from the expert historians Edward Gibbon and Flick and Leopold von Ranke and Adolf Harnack about this matter. In his famous Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon indicates that pagan Rome disappeared only to reappear as papal Rome. In his Rise of the Medieval Church, A.C. Flick declares that out of the ruins of political Rome arose the great moral emperor in the giant form of the Roman Church. In his History of the Popes, the famous Leopold von Ranke states, under the protection of the Holy Roman Emperor himself, the power of the Romish bishop raised itself. And in his celebrated What is Christianity, the renowned church historian Adolf von Harnack insists that the Bishop of Rome was the chief person there in Rome after the emperor's disappearance. The Roman Church, in this way, privily pushed itself into the place of the Roman world emperor, of which it is the actual continuation. The empire has perished. It has only undergone a transformation. The Pope, who calls himself king, and Pontifex Maximus, or supreme priest, is Caesar's successor. Now, this identification of Daniel's stout and arrogant anti-Christian Roman horn with the continuing institution of the Romish papacy is certainly not to be construed as any attack whatsoever upon Roman Catholics. Still less should this be regarded as an attack on the many orthodox biblical doctrines of Christianity still held by the Roman Catholic Church, even though obscured by her many peculiar heresies. Nor may this identification of the institution of the papacy with Daniel's stout and arrogant horn even be interpreted as an attack upon the questionable character of any one pope or upon any specific popes. But this identification of Antichrist, the little horn of Daniel 7, with a Romish papacy, should very definitely be regarded as an expose of the unscriptural office of the continuing papacy as such, as well as an expose of the related errors of Vaticanism and Romanism. It should also be seen as a critique of Rome's unfaithful Eastern Orthodox and liberal Protestant daughters in the worldly council of churches, etc. For, as Martin Luther pointed out, Rome and her unfaithful daughters held, and to a considerable extent still hold, Christ's true church in Babylonian captivity. Moreover, the once little horn, as it continues to grow into a big or stout horn, may ultimately embrace not only papally dominated Romanism, but even non-papal and not yet papal powers. Such powers might well include the apostate liberal Protestant and Eastern Orthodox groups in the worldly council of churches, as well as the French Revolutionary Democratic Socialist Movement and its further offshoot and refinement, the International Communist Conspiracy, as well as ultimately even other non-Christian religions such as Islam. Historically, however, the papacy itself is the very leader and standard bearer of that wicked and abominable kingdom of the Antichrist, as Calvin described it. The papacy itself is the very heart of the continually growing Roman stout horn. For Daniel's stout and arrogant horn is described as a man, compare the Pope, with intelligent eyes, compare the worldwide papal intelligence system, and a great speaking mouth, compare the royal we in the papacy's ex cathedra pronouncements. Furthermore, the arrogant and stout horn wields political power, as can be seen by this horn's uprooting of 3 of the 10 political horns, This political power of the papacy was particularly demonstrated after the overthrow of the Western Roman Empire by Odoacer in A.D. 476, when the empire started splitting up into 10 separate kingdoms, later to be dominated by the Vatican. Those 10 kingdoms were probably those of the Anglo-Saxons in England, of the Franks in France, of the Alemanni in Germany, of the Burgundians in Switzerland, of the Suevi in Portugal, of the Visigoths in Spain, of the Lombards in northwestern Italy, of the Ostrogoths in Austria and northeastern Italy, of the Vandals in southern Italy and Africa, and of the Huns in eastern Europe. This political power of the papacy was also particularly demonstrated after the Christian emperor Justinian removed his imperial headquarters from Rome to Constantinople. Because, you see, that left the Bishop of Rome as the most powerful political person in Italy itself. After this, the papacy became very stout, and that stoutness ultimately extended even to the political domain when the papacy uprooted three of the first horns, namely the kingdom of the Lombards, of the Ostrogoths, and of the Vandals, all then in various parts of what is now Italy. Moreover, Daniel's arrogant and stout horn would seek to change times and laws, such as the moral laws of God. Compare here particularly the second commandment, which the Romish papacy has corrupted by her own vain ecclesiastical traditions and images and statues of Mary and of the saints and of other creatures. Compare also the seventh commandment, which the Romish papacy has perverted with her doctrine of practically universal compulsory clerical celibacy, while God says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," which positively means every man should have his own wife. And compare, too, especially the fourth commandment's Sunday Sabbath times, which the Romish papacy has attempted to supplant by her man-made feast days. The papacy is so stout and arrogant that it has not even hesitated to try to supplant the laws of God with its own vain traditions of men. Just listen to the 1772 Roman Catholic authority Lucius Ferraris describe the papacy. Quote, "The Pope is not a mere man, but as it were God, and the vicar of God. The Pope is likewise the divine monarch and supreme emperor and king of kings. Hence the Pope is crowned with a triple crown, as king of heaven and of earth and of the lower regions. If it were possible that the angels might err in the faith, or might think contrary to the faith, they could be judged and excommunicated by the Pope. The Pope is of so great authority and power that he can modify, explain, or interpret even divine laws." Unquote. Lucius Ferrara. Now, being so stout and arrogant, it is not surprising that the Romish new horn would not find it incongruous even to persecute the true saints of God. Indeed, the Romish papacy has done this almost since the Bishop of Rome was for the first time illegitimately called Pope or Papa or Father in the 7th century A.D. And ever since, papal Romanism has been notorious for her persecution of the Greek Orthodox, the Waldensians, the Wycliffeites, the Hussites, the Lutherans, the Calvinists, the Anabaptists, the Huguenots, and, even in our own century, South American and Iberian Protestants in Colombia and Spain and Portugal, etc. Now, as we have seen in the preceding, this period of Romish horn persecution of the true Christian saints, this persecution by the arrogant Romish papal stout horn, may be expected to last for time, times, and half a time, that is, apparently, 1260 years. But just as the arrogant horn, at the beginning of those 1260 years, only gradually grew from a little horn into a huge horn, a horn more stout than his fellows, or greater than the other political horns, so too is that stout horn only gradually to waste away at the end of those 1260 years. Previously, there were various prophetic termini a quo and termini ad quem, or various points of embarkation and of fulfillment of the prophecy for the period of the 70 years long Babylonian captivity. One such period ran from the terminus a quo, or the time of Nebuchadnezzar's overthrow of Jehoiakim, through the terminus ad quem, or the time 70 years later, when Cyrus gave the decree for the Israelitic temple to be rebuilt. That is, the 70 years from 606 to 536 B.C. Another such period of those 70 years ran from the terminus a quo, or the time of the actual fall of Jerusalem, through the terminus ad quem, or the time of the actual completion of the rebuilt temple, the 70 years from 587 through 517 B.C. So, too, many have submitted that there are also various termini a quo and termini ad quem, various points of embarkation and fulfillment of the prophecy demarcating even the subsequent prophetic period of the 1260 years. And in the following statements, we will take a look at some of these various different termini. First, thus the classic Protestants, there is the 1260 years stretching from the time that Stephen, Bishop of Rome, first claimed and usurped the preeminence over the other bishops and churches around A.D. 257. The following 1260 years then endured through the 1517 A.D. Protestant Reformation, which started with Luther's protest against the preeminence of the Bishop of Rome at the beginning of the 16th century. Second, thus Duffield, there is the 1260 years from the donation of Justinian in A.D. 533. At that time, Emperor Justinian gave state recognition to the Bishop of Rome as the earthly head of the entire Christian Church. These next 1260 years endured through 1793. Then the French revolutionist Robespierre established his reign of terror and formally abolished the Christian religion and the Christian Sunday. This was only one decade after the Treaty of Paris between Great Britain and the United States, in the name of the High and the Most Exalted Trinity, formally recognized the Declaration of Independence of the greatest Protestant nation on earth. Interestingly, the A.D. 533 donation of Justinian only became effective in A.D. 538, and that was exactly 1260 years before 1798. Then, after the successful counter-revolution in France, implicitly predicted in the 1637 Dutch States Bible, by the way, Napoleon's generals Berthier and Halle withdrew all state recognition of the Pope by imprisoning the pontiff in his own Vatican. Third, thus the 1618 David Piraeus and the later Mosheim, there is also the 1260 years from A.D. 606 through 610. Then, during the confusion following the death of the pontiff, the first pope, Gregory the Great, the Bishop of Rome was first called Pope, or Universal Bishop. The following 1260 years endured through 1866 through 1870. Then the papacy, revived after receiving its deadly wound by the French Revolution, and immediately thereafter again by Napoleon, lost its last papal state outside of the Vatican in 1866 through 70 under Garibaldi's and Victor Emmanuel's famous assaults. Fourth, thus Leopold von Ranke and W.F. Miller, there is the 1260 years starting in 756 A.D. Then, the Pope became a political beast after the German Emperor Pepin made him a political prince over a large dominion. That is when the Pope, as the stout horn, subdued three other kingdoms or horns and annexed their territory. And the following 1260 years would endure through A.D. 2016, at which time one could perhaps correspondingly expect the Pope to lose control of the Vatican, thus Moses Lohmann and Albert Barnes. Finally, there is the 1260 years from A.D. 800. That was the time the Pope implicitly arrogated to himself the theoretical supremacy over all political empires on earth by crowning Pepin's son Charlemagne as the emperor of the revived and Christianized so-called Holy Roman Empire. The 1260 years following that would then perhaps endure through A.D. 2060, by which time one may perhaps anticipate the Pope's political power will probably have been totally abolished. All of this, then, would point to a gradual rise and a gradual fall of the papacy. And this should by no means be surprising, for the Son of Man himself, whom the papacy falsely claims to represent, was also only gradually humiliated at his incarnation, birth, life, crucifixion, death, and burial, and he is only gradually being exalted at his resurrection, ascension, session, world conquest, and second coming. Indeed, even the devil himself is only gradually being trodden down in his fall from heaven, in the Protevangelium, at Calvary, by the victorious course of the gospel, in hell, and finally in the lake of fire. Because of the above-mentioned gradual rise of the papacy before the elapse of the 1260 years, and the gradual demise of the papacy thereafter, it is fitting that Daniel only shows the approximate duration of papal power. And he does this by finally somewhat elongating the 3.5 times of 1260 years to 1290 years, and even to 1335 years in the last chapter of his prophecies. Now, possibly, these different numbers of prophetic years, namely 1260 and 1290 and 1335, possibly they refer to different events as regards their fulfillment. If the above 1290 years are to run from Daniel's time, or from about B.C. 607 through 534, and if they are further to be followed by the 1335 years, those 2625 years in all would, of course, stretch down to about 2032 through 2105 A.D. And if those 2625 years are to run from the destruction of the sanctuary in A.D. 70, then, of course, they would stretch down as far as 2695 A.D. In that case, it is clear that there are, at any rate, 1335 minus 1260, or 75 years between the 1260 years, which ended with the above-mentioned important events of 1793 through 1798 A.D., and the 1260 years, which ended with the above-mentioned important events of 1867 through 1873. So, too, it seems that the destruction of the papacy may perhaps take place fully 1290 minus 1260, or 30 years before the destruction of the imperialistic kings or kingdoms with which it will then have allied itself. And that destruction of the kings, in its turn, may again take place fully 45 years before the completion of the evangelization of the whole world, or the actual commencement of the post-millennial reign of the saints, some 75 years after the complete destruction of the papacy. For this insight, I am grateful and wish to give credit particularly to the great Samuel Hopkins and Jonathan Edwards. Now, this elongation factor may conceivably shift the significant date, AD 2000, not only to the above-mentioned terminal dates of AD 2016 and 2060, but possibly even 30 years beyond 2060 to AD 2090, or 75 years beyond 2060 to 2135 AD. Accordingly, it may yet be fully a century after the disappearance of the papacy and its allies, before the saints achieve their victory over the international political beast, or before the complete evangelization of the whole world, or the saints' worldwide triumphant post-millennial reign begins to take place. Unlike the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation itself does not mention the 1335 or the 1290 days, but only the 1260 days, or the time, times, and half a time, or 40 and 2 months. So it is apparently from the time of the end of the 1260 day years, or thereafter onward, that the saints are finally to take the kingdom and to possess it forever and ever. And all of this, at least as far as the book of Revelation is concerned, again seems to focus the expected date of the end of the 1260 years at around AD 2000. A few quotations from the comments of famous authorities on Daniel 7 will sufficiently underscore the above. The great Edward Gibbon, in his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, wrote that Pope Gregory the VII was the founder of the papal monarchy and became pope in 1073 AD, so that the papacy, says Gibbon, should then lose its power 1260 years later, or by 2333 AD. Adam Clark, in his 1813 commentary on the Bible, wrote that the 3.5 times of papal persecution of the church mentioned in Daniel 7 verse 25, though principally fulfilled in the French general Berthier's capture of the Pope and imprisoning him in Rome in 1798, might probably still continue until 2015 AD. And Albert Barnes, the great Philadelphia Presbyterian preacher, in his 1851 commentary on Daniel, candidly remarked that we are at present, that is, in 1851 AD, when he wrote the commentary, not far from the termination and fall of that great papal power. In the following lecture, we will finish off these predictions in the book of Daniel, and then go on into the New Testament.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. You are welcome to make copies and give them to those in need. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. It is likely that the sermon or book that you just listened to is also available on cassette or video, or as a printed book or booklet. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."